This is Eleanor Albert, and today is November 5th, 2008, and I'm interviewing Converse Herrick Blanchard. Connie, could you talk a little bit about your early childhood and schooling?
Yes, a little bit. I was born about 2 p.m. on Tuesday, the 25th of September, 1923, in a hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. My parents lived then, and continue to do so, in Abington, Massachusetts. And my parents were Lyndall Converse Blanchard and Miriam Eliza Herrick. I was sent to a special private Montessori type, although I think this is before Montessori, Montessori type school, a small school conducted in a lady's house, actually. It was very good school when I went to kindergarten and first grade there. Then I started in the public schools of first grade and kindergarten was in Whitman, Massachusetts, which is the adjacent town to the south. I started in the second grade in public schools in Abington, and I went through elementary school, which was then through grade 8, and we at that time we only got through percentages. And then I started at Abington High School in the fall of 1937. Is that right? Yes. And the class of 1941. Several of whose members are still alive, and I graduated on June 22nd, I believe, of 1941, and that was a memorable date in World War II, although I don't remember now what was memorable about it. I think it had to do with the Germans invading Russia. My experience in Abington Public Schools was not the greatest because I joined it as a stranger in the second grade, and because I was quite interested in my studies in a community where that activity would carry no respect at all. At any rate, I graduated from high school in 1941. I applied to only one college, and it was Harvard, and miraculously I was admitted, and started college then in September 1941. And 3 months later, World War I started, and so after a year or two, I joined what was called the Navy's V-12 program, which was a program in which the Navy was training officers. And the Navy at that time, and I think maybe still is true, insists that every naval officer is a college graduate. And so there were a large number of us that were put through college. My last 2 years were collapsed into 3 semesters. I was in Cambridge only 2 years and 9 months, and I didn't really get a chance to sample the social and literary life of Cambridge. I majored in physics. Is it okay to turn it off?
No, yeah, well, just to try to figure out how you decided on your major and when your interest in science began.
Okay. That is kind of amusing. When I started at Harvard, I was pretty sure that I was going to study either history or mathematics or physics. And I learned within a couple of weeks of getting there that I was not smart enough to be a mathematician. And I learned in that notorious and wonderful course called History One, no longer given, that I couldn't read fast enough to be a historian. And at the end of my first semester, I got an A in my physics final exam, and so I decided that I would major in physics. The physics that I studied at Harvard was, at that time, for several different reasons, very poorly taught. At Harvard at that time, they made a point of using textbooks written by their own staff, no matter how bad. And our initial course of a textbook in math was a very old-fashioned one, which I found quite difficult. That textbook in physics was even worse, and took up matters in the wrong order. But we stumbled through that. At that time, it went well into World War II now. MIT and Harvard were big centers of the research that led to the development of radar and various other wartime electronic developments. And so we were strongly encouraged to study electrodynamics and electronics, which we did pretty much to the exclusion of anything else. So I got a poorly rounded education there in my major, although there were a few courses that I really enjoyed very much. As I said, I was only there 2 years and 9 months. Then I went on to do some stuff in the Navy.
And in high school, were there any science teachers that were sort of inspirational or
no? I had one math teacher for 2 years who was very good and who was very helpful. The science teaching in my high school was abominable. It was essentially non-existent. And I, as a result, when I started studying physics in college, I was way behind the game. I caught up after a fashion.
Was your family interested in your becoming a scientist, or did they?
My family is extremely interested in my becoming highly educated. Uh-huh. I don't think they cared what. Although it is true that my father was seriously undereducated, but he had a bent toward mechanical things, and he read books about science from time to time. In fact, he had been the photographer at the Harvard College Observatory in Arequipa, Peru, around 1914 to 1916. My mother had no interest in the science and tried to fill me full of Greek mythology, which I never took very seriously.
And did you have siblings who also went to college?
I have a sister who is 2 years younger than I and who is doing very well. She lives in Plymouth, Massachusetts, which is only about 20 miles from Boston, from Abington. Abington's halfway between Plymouth and Boston. And she attended Abington High School. and has about the same respect for the school at that time that I do. She went then on to Oberlin College, as had my first wife, Marty, who also went to Oberlin College 2 years earlier. My sister is doing just fine now for somebody who's 83 years old.
So when you graduated, you knew you would be going into the Navy, but
I was already in the Navy, yeah.
But did you have any thoughts about what your career would be when you got out?
Oh, I never had very much doubt that I wanted to do science and probably at a university.
I see. So how long then were you in the Navy?
I was discharged from the Navy. In the Navy, I got into the radar program again, and I learned a lot more electronics. And by the time they got through training me in that, the war was over. That 1946, I worked for a year at the Naval Research Lab in Boston. And then in 1946, in June, I was married to Margaret Alice Wheatley, who took only her senior year at Abington High School, having moved from Evanston, Illinois. We got married and we continued to work that summer, and then we went off to Wisconsin.
So that was 1946.
To Madison. And I was hired as a teaching assistant, and I acted as such for a couple of years. Interesting, when we drove to Madison, we had lucky to get an old car, and we drove and drove and drove, and finally we got to Madison, Wisconsin. We drove up Park Street, which was Route 12 at that time, and we just stayed right on Park Street, and we got to the circle by the side of the Student Union, right at the lake, and then we had arrived. And I worked as a teaching assistant, and then as a research assistant. I was there for until 1950. Marty had a job at a law firm, so that we had the GI Bill and that job and my teaching assistant, and so we did pretty well. We were not deprived at all at that time.
So had you gotten a PhD at that time?
But in 1950, I was a TA for 2 years, then I was an RA, research assistant. During that 2 years, I did my research and wrote my thesis and passed it in August of 1950. And then that was the end. Then I had a PhD.
And what was your area of study for your thesis?
My area was what is commonly known as just plain nuclear theory. In those days, nuclear theory consisted of studying how neutrons and protons stick together to make nuclei. And my thesis topic was the possibility that the force that holds them together might have a so-called velocity dependence. Force might depend on something other than just how far apart the nucleons were.
And who was your major advisor during that time?
My major advisor was Robert Green Sachs, who you'll hear about again later, because when I came back to Wisconsin. But he was a student of Maria Mayer, a Nobelist who was at Chicago, you probably heard of, and she was a student of Max Born. And Max Born was a student of somebody else that I don't know the story. One of my students traced this back, but I don't know without looking how you go back from there.
And were you satisfied with the courses in the department here at that time?
at that time, the coursework in Wisconsin was fairly informal and not very exhaustive. The research work was excellent. One of the things that was special about Wisconsin at that time was that most departments had three research students per professor. The Wisconsin department regularly had six research students per professor, and the students did a lot of teaching of each other, particularly the experimental students, of which I was not one of.
And coming from the East Coast, what made you decide to come to Wisconsin?
It was the only graduate school of any repute that I was admitted to.
I see.
And that because one of my boss at the NRL in Boston was Professor Rolofson, who came back here and had written a letter of in support of my application.
I
was very fortunate. My undergraduate grades were not all that great. I don't know what they were, but they weren't really great.
But you felt that your graduate studies were more fulfilling to you or your
research? Oh, yes,
research.
Of course, because then you really get into the whole thing.
And then after you got the PhD, did you have to leave or find a...
Yeah, well, at that point, I took a job at what used to be known as the National Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. And there I did theoretical research on electron scattering. I wasn't really very productive in that research. And in 1953, a friend of mine, a good friend of mine from co-student of at Wisconsin, had taken a job at Penn State. And he said, well, why don't you come up and join us? And I did. And that was the beginning of my real academic career. And I enjoyed it tremendously. Penn State was not a very strong institution at that time. It has since become a first-rate university. But at that time, it was pretty far back. At any rate, I was able to get... But they did have a nuclear reactor, and I was able to sort of bring a nuclear program there. And so that was a very busy time. And I did neutron physics and I did nuclear physics. And I was put in charge of a course which was new at that time, third semester elementary physics for engineers. And a few of us wrote a book for that at that time. And there were several of us from Wisconsin at Penn State at that time. It was a very nice time that we were all sort of good friends together. Then, in the summer of 1958, Professor Rolofson, whom I mentioned before, and who was chairman of the department, called me up and said, we need somebody to teach quantum mechanics this summer. Would you like to come and do that? And this was a key thing, because I said, of course, I said I would. And I gave a quantum mechanical course, which was well received. And then I went back to Penn State. But in 1961, Raleigh Rolofson retired as chairman. He stopped being chairman, he didn't retire. And he was replaced by Hugh Richards. And Hugh could see that the graduate program here needed some help by way of just plain taking care of the graduate students. And so I came here with the understanding that I have particular responsibility for taking care of and advising and teaching graduate students who were still teaching assistants before they had a research professor. The sequence in our department is very uniform. You teach for 1 or 2 years and then you become basically the property of some particular professor. So I accepted that job without hesitation because I thought that Wisconsin is a wonderful place. I still think that. And I think it even more today than it did yesterday. So from there on, my primary responsibility, as I saw it, was one of teaching in the graduate program and otherwise seeing that the academic program was as well organized as I could. And I spent a long time doing that. I was the only person in the department that knew every one of the graduate students, and there were 200 of them at any given time. I did some research and lots of studying, but mostly I taught and took care of the graduate students.
And so about how many years did you do that for?
I did that for 20 years, basically.
And over that time, did you see any change in the student body, any changes? I mean, it was a time when there were many social changes.
There were lots went on, of course. I'm not sure which one to address first. The academic program of the physics department has begun steadily upwards and is now a really very good program. And that's not by any means all my doing, but it's a very strong program. The graduate students are, a physics graduate student is usually a pretty serious person and pretty dedicated. It's really hard work. They, only a few of them got it particularly involved in the, what do we call it, the war protest years.
Mm-hmm.
I myself took quite a bit of interest in that because I thought it was an important question, and I did get involved with that. Do I see a change in the students? Yes, the students now are become better prepared, but also more and more specialized. And the graduate students now, insofar as I can see, although I'm not as close to them as I used to be, the graduate students now are very highly specialized. They're very good at using computers. They don't take the fun of looking at the whole of physics the way we used to be able to do. That's mostly because you can't do that anymore. I mean, physics is so broad and so specialized in so many different ways that everybody sort of has to be a specialist unless they're a super genius. And if there's, we don't have a lot, nobody has a lot of super geniuses.
And then did your students tend to stay in academia, or did they go off to commercial jobs?
Most students there are two things. Most students that come to the University of Wisconsin-Madison want to stay in Madison for one reason or another. Yeah. Most graduate students, of course, can't do that because there are not that many opportunities around. The best students, essentially all of our graduate students go on to do research either in industry or in academia. That's what they, that's the complete emphasis of our department. And you, what you do in our department, learn how to do research. It's, we have exams that people have to take at certain levels. But once they pass, you throw away the grade. We don't care. Mm-hmm. We don't care what grade you got there.
Mm-hmm.
This, now you are where you can do your research.
And are, did you find that the other faculty was supportive of working with graduate students and, you know?
Most of the faculty, that's where I came in actually, most of the faculty are completely dedicated to the research.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the one that took care of them until the students, until they were ready to do that. That's the way to describe them.
Mm-hmm. Until they had found someone that they wanted to
right.
work with in
right.
research.
And been accepted by them.
Mm-hmm. I see. So you said you did that work for about 20 years?
Right.
And then what?
Well, then I had a medical problem in 1980. And 1981, my wife Marty died, and so my life sort of changed then. But then, by then, I was one of the older people, and I continued to take a good deal of responsibility around the department, but mostly I did quite a heavy load of teaching, much more teaching than anybody else in the department.
Was that by choice?
Yeah.
Did you like to,
yeah.
you like to teach?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I took great pleasure in doing it.
And then how did it work with your advancing to a tenured position? When you were hired, what was
when I left Penn State, a student and I did a very, I must say, a very nice piece of research. Just for the record here, we named it for a self-consistent Thomas Fermi nuclear model. And it was a nice piece of work, and it introduced a new kind of force, internucleon force, which has been widely used by other people, and this established a very good research reputation for me at that time. And I was promoted quite quickly to full professor on the strength of that previous research.
Mm-hmm.
But I was hired to take care of the graduate students, and that's what I did.
And your teaching, which you said really became quite a full schedule in the 80s, did you take on new courses or did you?
I did a couple of things. I taught quite a wide range of courses. I taught graduate courses and undergraduate courses. As you get older, you go to teaching beginning courses because that takes a lot of time and effort. And the younger people don't want to do that and certainly don't try to do it well because they just don't have the time from their research.
Mm-hmm.
So I, toward the end, I mostly taught at the introductory level. But I had taught the intermediate level, and I had a very, very good graduate level course for which many of our older graduates now remind me of it. Also, I started a new course, which is being given on energy at a time. Actually, it was back in the 1970s when the oil crisis and the energy crisis first came up. This was motivated then not so much by global warming as just by fuel shortage.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's all one problem.
Mm-hmm.
I did start a course to that effect, and I have done a great deal of studying and teaching in that area.
And just to take a look at the physics department over the years, since you've been here for a long time, you mentioned that it's academically, it's really come a long way, but you know, UW is famous for having faculty governance and consensus. How did you feel the department functioned or over the years?
The department was pure democracy. And and still is. Now, I understand, I haven't been to department meetings for many years, but I understand that now the department is so big and has so many new, highly specialized professors that the communication at department meeting is not quite as good as it used to be. When I first came here, the department meeting was a luncheon every Friday noon, and people talked freely about all kinds of problems and decided things by majority rule. That worked very well. I'm not sure how well that is now working, but that's the format and things get done. So I don't think anybody's worried about that. Now, at the higher level, one of the most refreshing experiences I ever had is the first general faculty meeting of the University of Wisconsin, meaning that place, not all those other places, okay? And who led the meeting? The president of the university himself was up there. And he said, "Mr. Jones, what do you think about this or that?" It was inspiring. Anybody who wanted, most people didn't go. But if you had a particular interest, you went. And you got your question discussed.
And when was this?
It was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Are they still having those meetings?
No. Mm-hmm. Now the president, nobody even knows the president. I have no idea where the president lives or what he or she thinks. I don't even know who the president is right now. And that doesn't reach down to us now.
Mm.
Okay? We have a chancellor now.
Right.
The chancellor just retired as a good friend of mine because he was in my class. I'm very fortunate. I've had a lot of friends in high places. The recent chancellor, the governor, who grew up in that house right there, the former head of LNS, who was a chemist who was in my class. So, and of course we know the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Well, part of that, that's Madison to begin with. What was I? But then, all of a sudden, in the time of troubles, faculty members began wanting to make speeches about the troubles in faculty meetings. And the powers that be decided that was not a good idea. And so we got a faculty senate. And that faculty senate, as far as I can see, is a I was a member briefly of the faculty senate, and it was not fun.
Its main function appears to be to enforce the rules of the university.
I shouldn't speak too much about this because I'm not in touch with it now, and I haven't been for some time, and I was only briefly in touch with it. But my impression now is the job of the faculty is to approve what the chancellor has decided.
Mm-hmm. So your feeling is that the faculty governance is much less important than it was when you
It's much less
functioning.
It's much less democratically down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long way between the citizen of this community and the people who are running it.
And how do you think that happened? Is that just a function of some?
Well, it started, as I say, at the time of Troubles, when it happened in 67, 68.
And the administration just took over the power?
Yeah, that was one thing. The other big thing that happened is merger, but that's not really relevant to what we're talking about now. But that put in another step, another huge step.
Well, it's interesting to me how people like faculty like you who were here when there was a good democracy going, how that adjustment to a lack of democratic functioning was accepted by faculty.
This is a research university. That's a phrase that's come into meaning only in the last decade, I guess, maybe 15 years. Everybody in this faculty, as far as I know now, is hired to do research and judged and paid according to the quality of the research done. That is their first and effectively their only responsibility. You say research, you sort of do this when you say research. Okay. They don't care. They have, and now this is special for physics and chemistry and biochemistry. They don't care. Their research money comes from the United States government.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, in fact, I've had people, one of my colleagues tell me, I don't work for the state of Wisconsin. I work for myself. My client is the U.S. government.
Well, yeah, but you still have arguments over space and staff support, and people want
our department has been very hard-nosed about space, demanding it when they needed it. Although I must say, when I first came here in 1946, our department was terribly crowded. There were 10 of us TAs in one small office. But the department learned how to be really tough about demanding space. And first, they expanded up through through Sterling Hall, and then over into the old chemistry building after the bombing, when the chemistry building had to be redone. The physics department is now, and has been for some time, very adequately housed. And it's because they all get together and browbeat the dean, in effect. There was something else I was going to mention.
Now, this is the dean of
LNS.
LNS, okay. Your department is LNS. And how about like staff support or what,
our department, when I was a student here, had two ladies in the office, a few guys in the machine shop, and a couple of other guys who were just around and did whatever was needed. Okay. Now, there's just dozens of people, dozens. And mostly supported by, not entirely, but mostly supported by research funds.
Mm.
Directly supported by research funds.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that our department right now has a row of offices, which is the department office. And every one of those offices, there's a person. And partly this is expresses the fact that life is now more complicated. Mm-hmm. The bookkeeping for the department is more complicated. But still, I think that we tend to be a little overstaffed in that department.
And had you, with working with students, did you run into a situation where a student couldn't get a grant or a researcher?
The professors get the grant.
What happens in the department if that happens? Does the department carry them, or?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. A person, if a person wants to study such and such, and he seems qualified to do so, and he says, "Yeah, I can't find a support here," we say, "Okay, you can teach for another year." Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you find somebody, or else find somebody else, and.
Now, how did it work with the chairmanship of the department? Was that rotating?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it settled down to being every 3 years. But earlier, it was rather irregular. Rawson was chairman. When I went there, the chairman, a very nice older man that I can't say the name of right now. Rawson became chairman right after the World War II, and he was chairman until 1961. By general consent, he did it. Everybody's happy. So he was reelected by acclamation year after year. But when he quit, and Hugh Ridges took over, then and hired me to help him take over. Then it became more, who's going to be chairman next year? And Hugh was chairman for several different terms in while I've been here. But now it's settled down to somebody agrees to be chairman, and it's agreeing to be chairman. It's not regarded as a. It's regarded as an onerous burden.
Mm-hmm. Is there a financial recompense for it? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
When you become chairman, I think it's true. I don't really know this firsthand. When you become chairman, there's a committee in our department. It's called Salaries and Promotions. And it's a committee of full professors who recommends promotion to associate and from associate, and recommends salaries. And the chair goes with those recommendations to the dean, and the dean and the chair decide what the chair's salary is.
I see. And did you enjoy it when you were chairman? Or?
I was never chairman.
Oh, you didn't want
to?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was associate chairman for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And was that a lot of administrative?
Was taking care of the graders.
Oh, you were, that was still?
Yeah, that was my job.
Yeah.
And teaching and doing a little bit of research from time to time.
Now, how did the makeup of the department change in terms of...
Oh, I should say one other thing.
Yeah.
In all this, seven students completed their PhD research with me. Mm. So I was involved in their research.
Were they all in different years? Or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What I was going to say is, how did the makeup of the department and also the students change? You know, were there more women coming in or more minorities at any time? Or
I'm not sure what how to respond to that. Of course, the department changes as time goes on. is getting larger. One thing I can say. When I was a graduate student, everybody knew in the department what everybody else was doing. Mm. And you could describe to a third party what that guy was doing. Not which screwdriver he's going to pick up, but I mean, in general, what he was doing, what he's concerned with, and how he was doing it. The field is now so specialized and elaborated and branched. What do I mean? I mean, there's all kinds of physics now. When I first came here, this is the department where you studied nuclear physics, or else X-rays, or else spectroscopy, and that was it. Okay. And there was basically one journal. If you read that journal, you knew what was going on. Now it's totally different. Mm-hmm. And now when I ask a professor a question that I want the answer to, he says, oh, you better talk with him. Mm-hmm. So it is a different world in that way.
Sounds very different. But, physics has predominantly been populated by male students. Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have this year 20-some new graduate students. Astronaut undergraduates after this, but new graduate students. There are 3 women, and they're all Chinese.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our undergraduate program has expanded in recent years since I've been involved. I never was strongly involved with the undergraduate program. And there do seem to be quite a few female undergraduate students now. But physics is done mostly by males. Mm. And I'm convinced that this is primarily because women are not interested in that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They're just not. It's nobody's fault. It hasn't anything to do with differences of ability. It may be that.
Right.
But what I know it is, and I've had, and when I was teaching undergraduate course, every once in a while spotted a female student that I thought had real promise. And I try to encourage them. It's very hard. Mm. They don't want to do it.
Now, I know that some schools have 2 different kinds of introductory physics. Something they call physics for poets,
yep.
I think, at Harvard.
Yep. Yep.
Do they have that?
Oh, yes. In fact, that phrase was originated on this campus by Professor Bob March, who wrote a book by that title. And I could show you the book if you want. Talking about physics in a well-informed way. There's no pretense that the student will come out being able to work the kind of problems that a physics major could work. Yes, there's that level. Then there's the level of that, most pre-meds take.
Mm-hmm.
And this, most pre-meds, unfortunately, and that is the non-calculus, that's called college physics. And there you do learn how to do a few problems. Then next is a level for the engineers. And they work pretty hard. And then it's a class for the science majors, which is the one I like to teach. And there you give them as much as you can. So there's at least 4 levels. And in fact, there's a 5th level because we have something called physics in the arts. And that's a laboratory course in which people study what happens in music and what happens in light and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So, yes, there are at least five levels of introductory physics here.
Mm-hmm. Was that the case when you came, or has that...
When I came, there was no physics for poets.
Mm-hmm.
There was no physics in the arts. Yeah, there were three. No, wait a minute. No. Basically, there were just two when I came and worked, non-calculus and calculus.
And then when did you retire?
I formally retired in June of 1990. I agreed with the dean that I would teach half-time for the next year and a half. And so I had my last regular class in December of 91.
And was that a difficult decision for you to stop your full participation?
Yes. Yeah. Difficult? It was not a festive occasion. On the other hand, I felt it was a time for me to get out of the way. Then you could hire somebody who was younger and smarter and cheaper than I.
But just since your retirement, you've stayed very active in the field, I think.
I have done quite a bit of teaching and some department work still, yes. Not very much.
Well, you did some teaching in the public schools.
Oh, yes. That was my big retirement program.
Well, is that still going on?
No.
I know you're not doing it.
No, it's not a program. It's just me.
Nobody else does it.
Mm-hmm. I've tried to interest a few people in it, but nobody. And it is quite a handful. It is not quite a full-time job, but what I would do is gather together a box, a large box, but small enough that I could carry. And I had equipment in it, all kinds of equipment. And I would go to any third grade class that would invite me. And they were all happy to invite me as soon as they learned that it was free. And I'd do experiments for an hour. And that was great fun. I did 1,670 classrooms.
Oh, wow. And how many years were you?
13 years.
Wow.
And this is about right. And they, at 20 kids per classroom, that's about 33,000 kids.
So wow.
I quit that. I guess it's 4 years ago now, for two reasons. One is, it was getting tiring. The other is, I didn't think I should be driving that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quit that, and now I couldn't dream of doing it.
But now you're still teaching it in the retired...
Plato. Yeah, I've been giving classes in Plato. That's fun.
Yeah. Well, looking back on your many years, what advice would you have for someone who is looking for a career in science at UW to a young person who was considering that?
Well, I guess you don't very often meet students who want to do this and who don't have some qualifications to try.
Mm-hmm.
I would never say don't study physics. I must say that right now, and for some time, there have been more PhD physicists created who want to be professors than there are professor jobs, by quite a long way. There are limitless opportunities in industry for people good with computers and who are good with material science. There are an awful lot of people who study cosmology, and cosmology is fun and all that, but there can be just so many professors of cosmology. And the same goes with string theory. String theory particularly is very, very abstract and obscure subject. We have a whole group of people studying string theory.
Graduate students?
Graduate students and professors.
So you would have to say to young people that...
you better love it for its own sake.
For its own sake, that the jobs are difficult to get in academics.
In academia, yes.
Yeah, be prepared for that. And this is a kind of a hard question, but looking back, would you have done anything differently, you think?
Oh, lots of things.
Really?
Yeah. But, let's see, well, I mean, I think everybody can think of things they should have done differently. I think maybe my ambition overreached itself. I'm very happy that I was able to do what I did. I could have done it better in many different ways. I did work as hard as I could, but it wasn't very hard. You
know. Oh, well, I think you have a high standard.
Well, yeah, you have to. Yeah.
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 And it sounds like you are really a born teacher, and that's something that...
I think if I have a talent, it's to explain physics to people, yes.
So it's wonderful that you've shared that with so many people.
Well, that's right, and I do enjoy doing it.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say? Anything about your career here, or?
I doubtless will think of a lot of things tomorrow or the next day, but right now.
Well, I can come back. We've been talking for quite a while.
What time is it now?
It's 10 after 3.
Okay.
So we have been.
What is your appointment? What do you allot for an appointment?
Well, it's I mean, usually about this long is about as long as people can really. But there's always the possibility of.
You want to turn this thing on International, a chapter of Amnesty International. And I attended a meeting, I think at Press House, of people who were interested in this. And there was, I don't know, maybe 10 people there. And we talked about it for a while, and we had some information from AI itself. And I could see that I was the oldest person there. And so I said, I'll arrange the next meeting. And that went on for 9 years. So I was the chair of the Madison group of Amnesty International. We did a lot of interesting work, trying to get the release of prisoners of conscience. Mm-hmm. And we have several different cases. I think in some cases we were able to make a little bit of difference.
And is the chapter still
I do not know. I parted company with Amnesty International when they changed their mode of operation. and there was much, they changed to a mode that was much less concerned with direct contact with prisoners of conscience. And that's what they were good at, and I didn't think they should have left that track. And I gave up on them.
And so their main focus was on working with governments?
Or? Their main focus was, I don't know, you know what, a prisoner of conscience is a technical phrase.
Right.
And it's a prisoner of conscience, some of the Amnesty International has inspected the record of and concluded that they are being held that have never not been convicted of and have not committed any violence and are being improperly held, retained, detained,
mm-hmm.
or possibly even tortured and stuff like that. And we had a lot of cases in Argentina and Uruguay with those years, those terrible years when they were really disappearing people.
Mm.
The disappearing was a technique against the amnesty. You can't ask for a prisoner if he's not there.
Mm.
Anyway, I did that work with a group for about 9 years.
And were any students in the group?
Or oh yes, it was mostly students.
It was mostly students.
Yeah,
it's interesting. And then you were talking about what your current.
This is just an observation of how, in a department in which there were a great many graduate students using a few pieces of equipment, and the one I really know about is the electrostatic tandem electrostatic accelerator. And there were four professors, all of whom were close friends of mine, and each one of them wanted to do experiments using that accelerator, and you could only do one experiment at a time. And for years and years and years, they shared that without any squabbling that I could see. That was a sort of a miracle that they could do that.
Well, it's actually sounds like the level of cooperation in the department was pretty high.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very high. And that was a repeat, partly because everybody knew what everybody else was doing.
Yeah. So it was personal. It was.
Oh, it was very much personal. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it was a nice environment to be in.
It's always well. I think it's always been, as these things go, a happy department.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Then, I guess we were talking a little bit. When we turn off the machine about your current concerns, which now seems to be focused a lot on climate change.
Yes, well, it is a really, really urgent question. And it's not at all clear that anything can be done about it. Because there's a huge, huge industry. The coal-fired electrical generating industry, which is absolutely essential to keeping the lights on.
Mm.
And if we somehow got to replace that, and nobody is doing much about it.
Mm.
And gas, natural gas and oil are not the answer. It was something entirely different as they happen, and it's not happening.
Well, I guess you are very much concerned with the state of the world. You have several grandchildren who will be growing up in this world.
Oh, they're going to have a terrible time.
Really? Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. But
yeah. Well, thank you very much. Any, yeah, well, for your last words.
You don't have to thank me. You're just doing your duty.